Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's a catchy rhyme with enough wit to make it indispensable on the playground, and yet no one makes it out of grade school without recognizing it for the fiction that it is. I actually find it incredible, really, that the saying is so pervasive and yet so obviously false at the same time. Not only will words hurt us, but they have the power to deal wounds that fester long after our broken bones have mended. Compared to sticks and stones, words can be weapons of mass destruction. Words can start wars. Words can end marriages. Words can build up churches, but words can just as easily destroy them. And that is an issue that we regularly face. It is an issue, I believe, that will be facing the audience in our text today as we dive into the book of 1 Peter. So if you have your text with you today, I'd like you to meet me there in the book of 1 Peter. Now, normally, when we begin an epistle, as you all become accustomed to, I give a little bit of historical background to the letter so that we can have an idea of the time and the circumstances that prompted his writing, kind of give us a little context as we move into what the author has to say. Unfortunately, with our letter today, there are very few areas of agreement, at least for my part, on those issues. The date, the audience, the location of writing, and the circumstances behind the letter. All of these hangs on how one interprets the epistle. And as far as I can see, much of it hangs on the presuppositions that the interpreter actually brings to the epistle. So as far as we can go, as far as I feel comfortable saying on the outside, not to taint our view going in, this letter was written by the Apostle Peter. And it could not have been written earlier than in the mid-50s because the mailman who delivered the letter was tied up until the mid-50s. So we know it was sometime towards the later end of Peter's life. We think he died in the mid-60s. But sometime between the mid-50s and the mid-60s, he produced this letter. And for everything else, we're just going to have to listen to Peter and let Peter tell us what's going on. So if you will, since this is our first week, by now I think that y'all know what we're going to be doing in this book. Our goal is just to get our feet wet, to get familiar with the lay of the land. We want to discover who's causing the problem in this letter, and we want to figure out exactly what that problem is so that we have something to work with as we march through. So we want to find out who's doing the problem, who's causing the mess. Who's causing the mess, and we want to figure out what exactly the problem is. So let's just start right at the beginning. Chapter 1, verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood. May grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure. Now, we've spent a lot of time in Pauline epistles, and the things that he wrote during his missionary journeys, at least. But with this new author, with this new audience, we have to ask the question that we kind of took for granted with Paul. With Paul, who's he writing to? Well, he's writing to the church normally that it's addressed, you know. To the Galatians, to the Thessalonians, to the Corinthians. Who is Peter writing to? Who are those who reside as aliens scattered throughout, and this is the area we want to think of as Asia Minor. Okay, scattered throughout Asia Minor. Well, we don't really have to speculate. Peter's going to tell us, if you look at chapter 2, verse 11, he will address them again, beloved. I urge y'all as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Okay, so if They're supposed to be on their best behavior among the Gentiles. They are not the Gentiles. And if they are not the Gentiles, then that makes them the Jews. Okay? Peter is writing to believing Jews. Jews that have welcomed Jesus as the expected Messiah. And that's really exactly what we should expect Peter to be up to. You might recall, Paul made this point back in Galatians. I'll just read it for you, but he was speaking about this in Galatians chapter 2 when he was talking about meeting with the other apostles in Jerusalem and discussing his ministry. In Galatians chapter 2, verse 7, he says, Paul says, "Seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter to the circumcised, for he who effectually worked for Peter in his apostleship to the circumcised, effectually worked for me also to the Gentiles. And recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas," that's Peter, "James and Peter and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me," Paul, "and Barnabas, the right hand of fellowship, so that we," Paul and Barnabas, "might go to the Gentiles, and they," James, Peter, and John, "to the circumcised." So it shouldn't surprise us that we find Peter or James or John writing to the Jews, because that was their ministry. That was their apostleship. Their ministry was the opposite of Paul. Paul's going to the Gentiles, they're going to the Jews. In fact, if we were to look at the book of James, James is the book right before 1 Peter. If you were just to look at the address, you would read this: "James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. Greetings." He's writing to the Jews who have been dispersed. And I know we finished Revelation not too long ago, but if you recall, in John's message to the seven churches, twice he speaks of those who say they are Jews, but are not, but are actually a synagogue of Satan, a church of Satan. So there's a moderate possibility that even though it says he's writing to the seven churches in Asia, like Peter is writing to these churches in Asia, he may be writing primarily to Jews as well, since that was John's ministry. But here, at least we can know, in 1 Peter, Peter is writing to Jews, which, as we've mentioned, are having very different struggles than, say, the Gentiles in Galatia. The Jews don't have to be instructed on what the Christ is. They don't have to be instructed on one Creator God. They don't have to be instructed on atonement or any of those basic things. They know the Old Testament. Now, they may need an initial crash course on Jesus and the resurrection, but they've got the basics down. But that doesn't mean they don't have any issues. So Peter is writing to Jews, Jewish believers who are scattered. They are in what's called the diaspora. They're out of the land of Israel. They're living outside of the land of Israel. They're in the times of the Gentiles. They need a new Exodus, right? They need a new Moses to come and fix things for them and get them back home. But right now they are scattered. And that begs the question, where is Peter writing from? They're scattered. Where's he? Most people will say that Peter wrote this from Rome. But I find it interesting that every time Peter brings the subject up, whether in verse 1 to those who reside as aliens, or verse 17, my NASB translators blew it, he's talking about those, if you address the Father, if you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, the NASB renders it, "Conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on earth." But on earth is not in the text. They just completely threw that in there to try to figure out what was going on. It really just says during the time of your sojourn. It's not general believers stay on earth. It's during the time that these aliens are sojourning in a Gentile land. But again, he's talking to them during the time of y'all's sojourn. Or again, in chapter 2, verse 11 that we just looked at, I urge y'all as aliens and strangers. It's always the y'all group. It's never the we group, or this is how I do it. It's, let me tell y'all, this is what y'all need to do while y'all are dealing with this. Now that is interesting, because while he doesn't include himself in the aliens and strangers group, that doesn't mean that he doesn't include himself in any groups in the book. Because he does. When you get to the fifth chapter of the book, you will find Peter saying this: therefore, I exhort the elders among y'all, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. So he doesn't call himself a fellow alien, but he is a fellow elder. Now, call me crazy, but I don't think that back in the first century there were folks running around with the title elder who were not a member of a church. You know, they weren't doing it like we do, where you have a denomination and they just ordain you and then you're kind of a free agent running around. You're an elder looking for a church. That's not how they're rolling, okay? If you are an elder, you are doing something in an assembly. You are a member of a particular assembly with authority over that assembly. So he is presently an elder, which we have to ask, where? An elder of what church, Peter? I mean, obviously they know. It's assumed that they know. He doesn't have to say, by the way, I'm over here in Antioch serving as an elder. You know, got a couple years under my belt there. He just says, as an elder, you know. Well, it's interesting. If we were to go back to Galatians, we were there. I won't read it for you. I'll give you the cliff notes. If you were to read the first two chapters in Galatians, you might recall Paul is giving you the rundown of his history in short form. Because in Galatians, remember, the problem is that Israel is pressuring Jewish believers to pressure the Gentiles to circumcise. And they're doing that so that Israel will stop hitting them. They're like, leave us alone. We're getting them circumcised, okay? And Paul's telling these Gentiles, don't do that. Okay, they're trying to add works to your faith. They're adding something to the gospel. Don't do it. And the way he goes through his argument then is he's trying to explain how he is legitimate. He is not someone who is a man pleaser who just changes the message everywhere he goes. He said, I give this message everywhere. I wore Peter out when he wasn't doing it straight. Peter, who is a man of repute in Jerusalem, that guy. He took my rebuke. So he goes through his history, and the way the history goes is Paul comes to faith in Jesus, and then he waits for 3 years. You know, he's like, man, what did I get into? Let me rethink things. 3 years later, he makes a trip to Jerusalem and explains the reason I went down there was to see Peter. And while he's there, he's like, I didn't see anybody else but James. James is in Jerusalem, Peter's in Jerusalem. Then he goes off for 14 years and comes back to Jerusalem. And Peter, James, and John are there. And he sees them again. And then time passes and Peter comes to Paul's neck of the woods. Peter comes out to Antioch. And during that time, Antioch is the missionary church that sent Paul and Barnabas out. But during Peter's stay there, James sends some Jews along to catch up with Peter over here at Antioch. And when they show up, Peter starts acting funny. And Paul says, that doesn't cut it. And Barnabas is getting caught up in all this mess and he has to call Peter out. Now, where is James? Well, James has been in Jerusalem this whole time. He's an elder in Jerusalem. And he's sending men to go meet up with Peter, who came from Jerusalem. See, Peter is always in Jerusalem in the story. Every time, you know, he'll travel out, but then he comes back to his port. We always find him in Jerusalem because he's an elder of the church in Jerusalem. Okay, he's preeminent among the apostles, so you're going to find him in the church in Jerusalem. In fact, if you're looking at the Jerusalem Council, Acts chapter 15, when Paul and Barnabas have to come and explain, well, this is how we're doing it, it's Peter and James that stand up to say, hey, look, this matches the Old Testament. This matches with what we see the Spirit's doing. So they're in Jerusalem. So he doesn't include himself, I believe, in this alien group. He considers himself an elder. I think he's at Jerusalem, but those aren't the only reasons I think that. Let's also look at the mailman. We mentioned the mailman already. We find him at the end of the letter. In chapter 5, verse 12, Peter says, "Through Silvanus, our faithful brother, for so I regard him, I've written to y'all briefly, exhorting and testifying what is the true grace of God." Stand firm in it. Well, I ask, who is this Silvanus fellow? Well, we just mentioned the Jerusalem Council, right? Paul and Barnabas in Acts chapter 15 had to come over to the Jerusalem Council and make sure everything was cool. And Peter and James gave them the thumbs up, and they sent them back to Antioch with a little epistle, a little letter saying, "What y'all are doing is great. We don't want to add anything to it. No works. Just stay away from idolatry, and you guys are good." But it wasn't enough just to send a letter along. You know, they didn't want to look like Paul and Barnabas maybe forged this thing. So he sends along a couple witnesses, trusted men from the church in Jerusalem, a man named Judas and a man named Silas. And what we find is that even though Silas came back after that, pretty soon after that, Paul tried to go on a second missionary journey. But Barnabas and Paul had a disagreement about John Mark. He says, "This guy is worthless. He blew up our first missionary journey. We're not taking him along." Well, Mark is Barnabas' cousin. He's saying, we're taking him along. Paul says, "We're not doing it." So they had such a sharp dispute about it that they split. Barnabas says, "Fine, I'll take Mark." So Paul takes Silas, and he goes out on his missionary journey. And he goes to places like Thessalonica, like Corinth. And we actually have a record of that in the letters, the address to 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, and 2 Corinthians. He'll mention it. But he doesn't call him Silas. You know what he calls him? Silvanus, because that's his Roman name. So he's the one that came from Jerusalem, has been traveling around with Paul during his second missionary journey. He gets done. At some point, he makes his way back to his home church, I'm thinking. Where's his home church? Jerusalem. Now Peter says, "Hey, got a job for you. Take this back to those churches in Asia. You know, Galatia, Bithynia, those guys. Go back, bring the Jews this letter." That's what I think's going on. So I think all of this, you start putting it together. You see where Peter is. Peter is in Jerusalem. And by the way, for those of you that have been following along in our Revelation study, we just covered chapter 17 and 18 the past 2 weeks. That's dealing with who? The harlot, right? Babylon. And we're saying, who is Babylon the harlot? And I'm making an argument, at least in there, I'm saying, I think that the harlot is Jerusalem. Well, the interesting thing is at the end of this letter, Peter is going to give a greeting. "She who is in Babylon, verse 13, chosen together with y'all, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark." So he's in Jerusalem. Mark's there. He sent Silvanus. But I think, yeah, if he's in Jerusalem, he's calling Jerusalem Babylon. And the church is she who is dwelling in Babylon, which is Jerusalem. That's what I think is going on. So there we have it. Peter is an elder. He's sitting at the church and he's writing this letter to the people that have been dispersed. What's up? Now, why does Peter write this letter? What's the problem that's popping up amongst the Jewish believers all over the place that he's saying, we got to deal with this? Well, we're going to find out. Look at verse 3 of chapter 1. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for y'all, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this, y'all greatly rejoice. Even though now, for a little while, if necessary, y'all have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you haven't seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of y'all's faith the salvation of your souls." Okay. So So they are facing various trials, and these trials are putting their faith to the test. They are trials of faith. A faith in what? Verse 8, it's faith in a resurrected Jesus who they've never seen. They've accepted the apostolic message. They believed it matched the Old Testament. And now that faith is being challenged. Now, I don't know about y'all, but when I think of a trial of faith, I tend to think of watershed moments in life. The things that lead to dark nights of the soul. It's those moments when we are confronted with catastrophe or a confusion that challenges the very things that we believe to be true. It strikes us at our core. It puts us at a crossroads. Things like the loss of a child or the loss of a spouse. A crippling injury from a drunk driver or a sudden onset of a disease. A moral failing of a pastor or a parent. You know, I think of Ravi Zacharias, one of the most famous Christian apologists. There is no telling how many people came to faith through the ministry of that man. He was looked up to. He was kind of like the one card that at least the evangelicals had in their pocket to say, you know, well, what about Ravi? There's a man of high repute. There's a straight shooter. There's someone we can put our trust in. And he was a complete fraud. He was caught in all kinds of terrible abuse of women after his death. So it's like he got away with it. And there was a couple voices that spoke out during his life, but they got crushed by legal teams. So when all of it came out and all of it came down, I think of the crisis that must have come. I can't imagine if I had come to faith through his ministry. Or if, you know, you imagine someone you share the gospel with. When you fall, they're looking to you as the example. You're the standard in their eyes. You're the one they're looking to say, this is what a believer is like. And if it looks like you didn't believe, that's going to be a big problem for them. They're going to have a crisis. They're going to have to make a decision. Do I believe in this, or did I put my trust in the man or the woman for that sake? So I think of things like that. And that's the exact level of trials that most commentators see in the book of 1 Peter. They're imagining the Roman persecution under Nero, the suffering of Christians in Rome. Notice what the text says. What kind of trials? Ask yourself this when we're reading. What kind of trials are the Jewish believers in Asia Minor facing? Follow along. Look at chapter 2, verse 12. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slandered you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Chapter 13, verse 14. Even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed. And don't fear their, it's really fear. Don't feel that fear their fear. Do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that's in you with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience. Why? So that in the thing which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. Chapter 4, verse 4. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they blaspheme. Chapter 4, verse 14. If you are reviled in the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory in God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or some troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. And lastly, chapter 5, verse 8. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. But resist him firm in faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brothers who are in the world. What's going on? They're suffering, but how are they suffering? Are they facing lions and tigers and bears in the Colosseum? Beatings, imprisonments, and death? Sticks and stones? Most would say yes. And we can certainly understand why. I mean, after all, Peter does speak of the proof of their faith as though being tested by fire. And we just read chapter 4, but I'll back it up to verse 12. He says, "Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among y'all which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you." Now, it is true that when Nero comes along, he used Christians to illuminate the Colosseum. And by that, I mean he took them and he nailed them to crosses and he set them on fire to provide lamplight for the games. Nero's not on the scene yet. Or he's not doing that yet, I don't think. But all the same, he does that. They're saying it's on the eve of the persecution that's going to come under Nero. And when he's mentioning these things, he's talking about this terrible persecution that's going to take place in Rome. Naturally, if we're thinking of Roman persecution from the get-go, we might make that connection. But torches aren't the only things that set fires. You know, James actually mentions another agent. Just listen to this. You'll be familiar with the text. This is James chapter 3, verse 1. "Let not many of y'all become teachers, my brothers, knowing that as such will incur stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone doesn't stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now if we put the bits into horses' mouths so that they'll obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also. Though they're so great and are driven by strong winds, they're still directed by a very small rudder wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life, and it is set on fire by hell." For James, fire set by the tongue, by what is said. Whose church did James attend, by the way? Peter's. The church in Jerusalem. Maybe they've listened to the same homily, the same sermon. Notice Peter's application in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. "The one who desires life, to love, and to see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit." Watch what you say, fellas. Keep a lock on that tongue. Now, normally, when we talk about persecution, we're talking about more extreme forms of human depravity towards believers, right? That's what we think about. Those things exist. And we should not downplay them. But those things don't exhaust the meaning of persecution and suffering. Not in the biblical text. Biblically speaking, trials of faith come in all sizes. You don't have to be martyred to be mistreated for the faith. I think of the letter of Hebrews, which was also written to Hebrews. You see how he did that. The letter of Hebrews, and the author is charging them to endure, stick with Jesus, suffer with Jesus. He suffered unto death and he was resurrected. You guys can do it too. Think of all those people that went before you that went in the faith, you know, from Abraham onward. They suffered and didn't see the promise. They held to their faith. You guys endure. But in chapter 12, verse 4, he says, "Oh, by the way, you haven't resisted to the point of shedding blood yet." Yeah, maybe people called you names. Maybe some of you lost some of your stuff. but you have not been beaten yet. So stick with it. You know, they had not experienced persecution to the level that we normally associate with persecution. They were not getting martyred. They were getting oppressed. They suffered. They weren't martyred. And in reality, that level of persecution was not prevalent in the first century. That's why when we went through Revelation, we're looking at the churches. One of the churches, Jesus mentions Antipas, my faithful witness who was killed among y'all. Now, if they're just dragging out believers left and right to be martyred, what's naming one guy going to do? Now, it's important because that happened to him. The persecution had not broken out all over the place yet. That comes later, that second century. Okay, but the first century, it's not there yet. So in Peter's letter, the Jewish believers aren't being killed. They're being slandered. They're being reviled. They're being insulted. The social pressure is real. The heat is turning up. They're being bullied for their beliefs. That's what's going on. By who? Who's bullying the Jewish believers? Who are the antagonists? Is it the Romans? Look at chapter 2, verse 6. For this is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. This precious value then is for you who believe. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were appointed. Who are the disobedient ones? They are Jews. The Jews are the builders who rejected Christ. Remember, Paul made the point to the Corinthians, we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, to Gentiles foolishness. Gentiles stop listening at the word resurrection. Okay, when you're trying to tell them the gospel and you say a man came back from the dead, they say that's foolishness. And they still do it today. Heard Joe Rogan the other day on his podcast going on and ran about it. It's like, of course we know that people don't come back from the dead. You think these people were stupid? Yes, that doesn't happen every day. That's why it's a miracle. That's why it's a validation. That's why it's amazing. This is something that doesn't normally happen. The Gentiles say that's foolishness. The Jews don't have a problem with resurrection. They expect resurrection. They expect a resurrection of everybody, the righteous and the wicked, in the future. Their problem is that they rejected Jesus and crucified him. So now they are hardened against the message. You know, it's hard to convince somebody that they've done the wrong thing, right? It's easier to fool somebody than to convince them they've been fooled, that kind of thing. You know, we've made this decision. You mean to tell us that we crucified the wrong guy? That's where they're at. So now they're hardened, and it's not just the crowd in the synagogue. Notice, it's their bosses. It's their spouses. It's the people in their lives. Chapter 3, verse 1. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, that they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Verse 5. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you've become her children if you do what's right without being frightened by fear. So we're talking about the relationships between these Jews, the believing Jews, and the unbelieving Jews, and the conflict that they're having. That's why Peter quoted Isaiah 8 at the end of chapter 3 when he made that statement, do not fear their fear, do not be troubled. Some of you may recognize this. This was when Isaiah was commissioned. Remember, Isaiah is going to a people that is not going to listen to them, and he's preaching a message and hearing they won't hear, seeing they won't see, so that they won't understand and return. And one of the things the Lord tells him, he says, look, Chapter 8, verse 11 of Isaiah. Thus the Lord spoke to me with a mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, you are not to say it's a conspiracy in regard that all this people call a conspiracy, and you're not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It's the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy. And He shall be your fear. He shall be your dread. Then He shall become a sanctuary, but to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Many will stumble over them. They will fall and be broken. They will even be snared and caught. Bind up the testimony, seal of the law among my disciples, and I'll wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I'll look eagerly for him. Now, when you read that in Isaiah, and he is told not to fear what they fear, who are they? It's Israel, the ones that the Lord has hidden his face from. When we come to 1 Peter chapter 3, and he says, verse 13, who's there to harm you if you prove jealous for what's good? Even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed. Do not fear their interpretation and do not be troubled. Or do not fear their fear and do not be troubled. Who are they? Same group. It's Israel. It's the Jews. It's the unbelieving Jews. Do not be troubled, but, verse 15, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Always ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. But with gentleness, with reverence. So it's another Saturday in the synagogue, and here we go again. Joe Israelite stands up and he's calling out Bob for his hope. And he's trying to embarrass Bob for his faith. Now, what is the hope of Bob? What is the hope of these believing Jews? What do they hope in? Chapter 1. We read it. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. A hope in the resurrection of Jesus. Explain that to me, Bob, how this false prophet who died on a cross, that's your hope? Walk me through that, Bob. So Bob, who believes that Jesus of Nazareth is the anticipated Christ of the Old Testament, he believes that he bore our sins in his body on the cross. He believes that through death and resurrection, Jesus established a new covenant by which believers are reborn into a new man, a new body made up of Jews and Gentiles with Christ as the head. Bob has a living hope, a living man that he is hoping in. As opposed to what? What is Joe Israelite hoping in? Think of the words of Jesus in John chapter 5 when he's speaking to the Pharisees. And he makes this statement in 5:45. Don't think I'm going to accuse y'all before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have set your hope. See, they hope in a dead man. Bob is hoping, the Israelite believer is hoping in a living man, Jesus. These guys are hoping in Moses, and this dead man somehow still finds the energy to accuse and condemn them. That's your hope? That's their hope. So Joe Israelite's over there chasing Moses. And Bob, Peter's telling this believing Jew, look, you got to hold his hand. When the opportunity comes in the synagogue, don't be offended. Don't be insulted in return. Insult for insult. What you really need to do is take the opportunity and give an answer from the Old Testament. You need to take his hand and walk him to Jesus and show him how Jesus is his Messiah, how he is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And Peter even gives him defenses. For example, chapter 1, verse 10, he says, look, as to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come made careful searches and inquiries to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating, as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. They already said that Christ was going to suffer. And then verse 18, knowing that you, believing Israelite, weren't redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life, inherited from your forefathers, the Mosaic way, But with precious blood as of a lamb unblemished, the spotless blood of Christ. We were redeemed from Moses through this suffering one. And he's going to go on and attach it to Isaiah 53, which we looked at last week. In chapter 2, 22, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, kind of like you guys are being reviled, he didn't revile in return. While suffering, he offered no threats. He kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed, for you were continually straying like sheep, but now you've returned to the shepherd, the guardian of your souls. He says, guys, this is the fulfillment of the Old Testament in a man. That's where my hope is. And he's telling him to point these believers in the right direction so they can see it. Now, here's a question. What exactly are they saying? They're slandering them. What's the charge? Listen to this, chapter 2, verse 12. They slander you as evildoers. But the interesting thing is before he's saying, look, you guys got to keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God. The they are these Jews. It's the bad guys. They see you guys hanging out with the Gentiles and they're slandering you as evildoers for it. Chapter 3, verse 16. Keep a good conscience, so in the thing which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. And then once again in chapter 4, verse 3. The time's already passed. Y'all could have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. And this, they're surprised. The unbelieving Jews are surprised that y'all don't run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they blaspheme. Look at these little Christs running around welcoming sinners, hanging out with these Gentiles. And they blaspheme. What are they getting attacked for? Socializing with Gentiles. It is guilt by association. Remember Peter's words to Cornelius. Acts chapter 10, he's sitting at the tanning house. Cornelius sends some folks over to go get him. The Lord gives him that vision of the animals in the sheet. He's up, I better go. And when he makes it to Cornelius' house, he comes in. And in verse 28 of Acts 10, he says, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That's why I came without raising any objection when I was sent for. Jews aren't supposed to hang out with you guys. I received a revelation, so I went with it. And it took him a couple, if you recall, the first time he told the Lord no. By no means, Lord! It's like, what do you mean you're telling him? How are you calling him Lord and saying no at the same time? But he does it. And it was evidently a struggle that went on in Peter's life. Remember the whole thing Paul had to talk about. Galatians chapter 2, we already brought it up in verse 11. When he came over to Antioch to see what was going on, when James sent that crew, listen to this. I'll just read a couple verses. Verse 11. When Peter came to Antioch, Paul opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. When they came, Peter began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But now listen to what he has to say. See, he's been through it. Now he's telling these Jewish believers, chapter 1, verse 22, since y'all have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for an unhypocritical love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. What is an unhypocritical love of the brethren? It's treating Jews and Gentiles as equal members of the body. It's having table fellowship with Gentiles. It's not making distinctions among yourselves. Saying, all right, you guys who are going out there, you're getting hit for this. Don't let that affect your behavior. And Peter's done it. They've been through there, done that, learned my lesson. Y'all don't do it. So these believers are under fire, but it's not sticks and stones. It is words. They're being torn down by their peers. They're being slandered. Reputations are being ruined. And Peter's going to say, look, I know you're catching a lot of flack from your Jewish friends who don't believe. And I know that for some of you, there's a temptation to respond in kind. Insult for insult. And for others, maybe there's a temptation to go along to get along. Separate from the Gentiles. Or maybe even separate from Christ. Just try to get out of their crosshairs. He's saying, do not do it. You have got to stand firm. So, he will say, abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Fleshly lusts like what, Peter? The former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. Your futile way of life, inherited from your forefathers. The way of life characterized in chapter 2, verse 1 by malice, deceit, hypocrisy, evil, and slander. You know, all the things that characterize what those guys are doing, the disobedient ones. Don't do any of that. Separate yourself from that. And to sum up, chapter 3, verse 8, be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for this purpose, that you might inherit a blessing. The book of 1 Peter is about living in harmony in a hostile world. It is about weathering the storms of social ostracism for the sake of the gospel. Dealing with slander, dealing with ridicule. It is about holding fast to what is true when it is unpopular, when you look foolish defending it, when nobody stands with you. It's about standing firm against the tide. So I think about that and I ask the question, what about us? Now, what is a correct understanding of this book have for us? You know, I think that when we're looking at the problem, a correct understanding of this book is likely to have one of two effects on us, to cause one of two responses. Either we're going to think, oh, well, they weren't nearly as bad off as I thought they were. Or we'll think, oh no, we are much worse off than I thought we were. Because he's dealing with issues that we run amok with. Because these issues don't catch headlines. We don't think of persecution as, you know, slander, reviling, misrepresenting one another, or being misrepresented. I don't want to diminish what's going on in the book. I mean, we think of the suffering of Christians in our minds. We do think of sticks and stones. We think of the stoning of Stephen. We think of the beating and imprisonment and martyrdom of the apostles. The persecutions that came later. We think of those kind of things. And when we do that, you know, we ratchet up the discussion of Christian faithfulness to these extremes, as though it's the thing that comes out in the extremes. If you're living in China, that's when you see Christian faithfulness. That's when you're called to hold the line. You know, when it's life and death, when you know, lose your livelihood, those are the times to stand up. In these other times, not a big deal. You know, not a big deal. But the fact of the matter is, we already face circumstances similar to what Peter is actually writing about in the book. The calls that he's actually calling to say, you have got to take a stand in this for doing what is right, even though the result is socially accounted. Okay, I mean, the fact of the matter is, in our day, social media has opened up a door of social criticism unlike any the world has ever seen. I mean, you can have more people hear something you say than any time in history. It can cost you sleep. It can cost you sanity. It can cost you your self-esteem, your job. If you're in Australia, maybe it'll cost you your freedom, or China. Or maybe it'll just cost you your sanctification. You know, somebody says something that hits you square and you decide to let it rip. Evil for evil, insult for insult. This is our struggle in the world. It is not only in the extreme times, it's in the mean times to hold the course. You know, the answer that Peter gives in this book that's supposed to be our solution. You know, what is the answer in our meantime? What's the same one in the extreme times? The interesting thing is, as we go through this book, he's going to hit one thing again and again and again. The answer to their problems is their living hope. It is the return of Christ. What will happen on the last days at his visitation? Okay. Keep your eyes firmly fixed on that. Not just in times of crisis, but in all times. Recognizing that he's the one that's going to come to judge and all things are going to get sorted out. So don't just live in the extreme times for the end times. Live all times in the mindset of the day that's coming. As we deal with the mundane, the day-to-day, the interpersonal struggles, nothing is mundane to the Lord. He's concerned with all of these things. He's concerned with our representation, our sanctification, and ultimately he will handle our glorification.